Firmcore.
Guys, joining me today for we've been on a hiatus. It's been a minute, guys, but here on Firmcore, we have alumni Adora Wilson I. Gomez and founder Alex Kirschenbaum. Woo.
Hello.
Well, like, you know, really self-sacrificing right now, missing the last part of the playoffs. I love that dedication.
That is dedication.
And it feels good to be back, especially in a time, uncertain times for cinema, this country, just like the world at large. But the things that unite us is great cinema. And here we're going to compare two solid movies that have entered into the Vampisphere.
Ooh.
It's The Christmas Miracle, that was Nosferatu, and The Summer Scorcher Sinners. So just breaking it down for people who have not seen one or the other, by the way, there will be spoilers. So if you didn't watch it, we're going to get into it. So you've been warned. Kicking us off, Alex, do you want to break down Nosferatu?
Sure. So Nosferatu is a 2024 American Gothic horror film written and directed by Robert Eggers. It's a remake of the 1922 silent classic Nosferatu, A Symphony of Horror, which itself was an unauthorized adaptation of Bram Stoker's 1897 novel Dracula. There was also a 1979 Werner Herzog remake of Nosferatu with Klaus Kinski and Isabelle and Johnny that's very good. Anyway, this 2024 film stars Bill Skarsgård, Nicholas Hoult, and Lily Rose Depp. Supporting cast includes Aaron Taylor-Johnson, Emma Corrin, Ralph Ineson, Simon McBurney, and Willem Dafoe. It was nominated for 4 Oscars and 1 none. Basically, a pretty straightforward Dracula story, given that it's sort of a German-channeled remake of the original Stoker novel. There are some mild changes, but it's pretty much that story again. It was solid. It's honestly my least favorite of the three Nosferatus, but it's still very good. Robert Eggers adheres to that whole old English dialogue that he loves so much. Lily Rose Depp is really good. Skarsgård just keeps doing these remakes where he like makes the part his own. This is a very different Nosferatu than the Max Schreck Nosferatu or the Klaus Kinski Nosferatu. Nicholas Hoult is fine, very replaceable, honestly, but he's not bad. He's just kind of there, and the character is just kind of there.
What I will say is, if Nicholas Hoult is like sort of your weakest performer in the entire film, that says a lot about overall your ensemble and the movie itself. Because I think Nicholas Hoult overall gives a pretty solid delivery across like most of the cinematography, even with like the weakest, sort of also sort of vampire adjacent, like Warm Bodies, for example, or the other vampire movie starring Nicolas Cage that he was in 2023.
Renfield.
Just saying, you know, some good material, I think Nicholas Hoult is shown to deliver, and I do agree that he was the weakest link.
I thought it was good. I don't know if I'm the audience for it, basically.
But before we get into the nitty-gritty on Nosferatu, let's maybe set the stage for Sinners. Adora, take it away.
Ooh, all right. So, Sinners, it's a 2025 American horror film written, co-produced, and directed by Ryan Coogler. It's set in 1932 in the Mississippi Delta, and the film stars Michael B. Is it Michael B. Jordan still, or are we going by Michael B.? We just know him really well, so I guess we're just going Michael B. But it's Michael B. Jordan.
I mean, yeah.
the plot is basically 1932. Michael B. Jordan plays twins, Smoke and Stack. They're World War I vets, former Chicago gangsters. They've just returned home to Clarksdale, Mississippi. They use some stolen mob money to buy a sawmill from a racist landowner so that they can open a juke joint for the local black community. Their cousin Sammy is a young guitarist, and he joins them, despite his preacher dad's warnings that blues music is dangerous. The twins gather a crew, so we get a lot of setup in the beginning, and I think this is part of what makes this movie so great, is they really take their time unfolding this world. And so you really get a sense of this crew. They're very humanized. You start really liking all these people, musicians, cooks, shopkeepers, even a bouncer. Meanwhile, we have our vampire character, Remick. We don't even know what he is exactly in the beginning. We just kind of know that he is not of this world. He is not good. He's Irish, randomly, which I really thought was a fun detail. He's fleeing vampire hunters. He gets into the house of a clan couple and turns them and then uses them to take over the juke joint after they hear Sammy's powerful music summoning spirits of the past and the future, which is probably my favorite part of the whole movie. There's the ending, but we'll get to that.
Yeah. And going back into like the, you know, its success overall, comparing itself to like Nosferatu, this made actually pretty, they actually did pretty similarly in the box office.
Well, but Sinners isn't done. Yeah.
Sinners is not done. The book, both currently 181. Obviously, Sinners, I think, had more of like a mass appeal, being that it felt like a little bit more contemporary. It had Michael B. Jordan and Michael B. Jordan. So really had the odds stacked in its favor there. Getting into it now, we've sort of set the stage. Initial takes with how they both sort of explore the classic trope of the vampire.
What I find interesting is Nosferatu is a ripoff of Dracula, right? They wanted to make Dracula. They couldn't get the rights. So they made their own version of Dracula. And what I find interesting is that Sinners seems to fall more in line with a Dracula type vampire, whereas Nosferatu is kind of its own invention. It seems like in vampire stories, there's two types of vampires, and you've got the Nosferatu style vampire, which is more, especially in this version, represents plague. Essentially, he's plague personified. He just wants to consume. He doesn't care. He doesn't turn people. There's no mention of stuff like garlic. I think maybe it's been a couple months since I've seen Nosferatu, but maybe there was some stuff repelling him with crosses. I don't remember. But they don't. Mm-hmm. It seems like Nosferatu came out of trying to do a different thing with vampires, whereas Sinners kind of follows a little bit more of what we think of when we think of vampires, which is more of the Dracula vampire, which is the garlic, the holy water, the crosses, the not being able to be invited into a house, burning at dawn. Although I think Nosferatu is the same. The whole thing, actually both plots end up trying to get him not to go back into the ground before the sun rises, and being summoned by somebody with supernatural abilities or a connection to this other world. But other than that, they really take the vampire thing in completely different directions. What I found interesting too about Sinners is the vampires are almost like a zombie vampire combo. I've never seen vampires turned, people turn into a vampire with a single bite, kind of the way a zombie would turn another person into a zombie.
Yeah. I think that is a great point. Like that sort of, you know, more immediate or shortened timeline for the transformation really served to like expedite sort of like the vampire takeover, where you look at things like Salem's Lot, for example, where like, you know, they get bitten, they have to go to ground. So like now days are passing and like it's really extending that timeline, versus here in Sinners, we're able to watch it happen like almost like 28 days later,
yeah.
A Dawn of the Dead, like instantaneous sort of, you know, spread of this like virus, right, in a way. I think with Nosferatu, you really hit on something where I felt like it reminded me a lot of like Guillermo del Toro's Pan's Labyrinth, where there's sort of like a mythical, almost sort of like fae element to it, where it was more rooted in sort of like this symbolic idea of what like the Dracula stood for, or like the vampire stands for. And it felt honestly more of a story of like sort of like sexuality and romance, rather than just like a classic like sort of like monster flick, which I feel like Sinners leaned more into that increasingly as the runtime increased. And I felt like where Nosferatu sort of like left this with more of like a poetic, nuanced ending, Sinners, to somewhat of my disappointment, sort of like ended up in sort of a CGI Marvel sort of like spectacle towards the end, which is like not necessarily what I personally felt like I wanted to see from it. I wasn't mad at it, but I felt like it set itself up throughout to really have more of an opinion, or more of like a message that it was trying to convey about, like, what maybe it means to be, like, what Black culture means to society and how it's, like, fed off on and, like, how it spreads. And maybe is that what they mean by, like, something being, like, sucked away and exploited? Like, does Remick, or is he, like, supposed to be, like, a stand-in for, like, the music industry or pop culture in general? Like, I don't quite know what Ryan Coogler was trying to say, and I feel like that's because at the end, it threw away a lot of the sort of, like, it burned a lot of the runway that it built leading up to the climax.
Interesting. I feel like I should mention, like, Nosferatu is very much Dracula to me, where it's like the sexy romance element is very much a part of the original story, and like Nosferatu follows all the beats of the first Dracula, like down to like the Jonathan Harker character, which is Nicholas Holt, going overseas to bring this evil count, in this case Count Orlok, but in Dracula, Count Dracula, over to, you know, Germany in this version, but London in the original. Dracula is seducing Mina Harker in the original, and then Ellen in this version from afar, with sort of a psychic seduction, and then eventually Ellen sort of falls for the creature, Mina Harker sort of falls for the creature, and in this version she chooses to sacrifice herself. In the other one, I believe Dracula is killed by like the Van Helsing character essentially, and she's sad because she's already been turned. Boy, that's a very traditional romantic narrative.
But here's the big difference. Dracula's hot and Nosferatu is disgusting.
That's true.
That to me is a big difference. To me, like, I would say if we don't say Dracula, I would also say maybe Anne Rice era vampires. Is, I feel like Anne Rice kind of revived this idea of like the vampire who's like sexy and brooding and is like sad that they can never see the sunlight.
It's the toxic male. It's just crazy. Just every bushwick bro we know.
Yes, they're both toxic males. But like, you know, Nosferatu, what I appreciated about this remake is they didn't try and make him alluring at all. He was just through and through, just absolutely nauseating from top to bottom. And I think that's probably the point. You know, when you watch like other versions of Dracula, not necessarily Nosferatu, although I'd say that one of the 70s was a little sexier, but is, you know, when you watch Dracula, like a Gary Oldman Dracula, it's a lot sexier. You know, you get scenes where, I mean, yes, Mina is seeing somebody who is hot that she is in bed with, but we see this disgusting monster. Whereas Eggers Nosferatu, there's never a moment where you're like, maybe you're like, he is disgusting. And he's literally a corpse. I can't even imagine how he smells. You know,
I think this is a great time for us to segue into performances between both films. I think even the voice that Bill Skarsgård gives him it's just...
That's a good point, It makes him gross. And also about Sinners, like, Sinners is very From Dusk Till Dawn core, with the vampires turning immediately. Like, that's exactly what they did in that movie, and it's all set in this part of, like, party location, which I really liked, because that movie rules, and not enough movies do that, where it's just a contained location, kind of Assault on Precinct 13, From Dusk Till Dawn setup. So... I thought that really worked. But it is interesting, the contrast with the vampire styles. Have you guys seen Fright Night?
Yeah, they really...
No, that's the Frighteners. That's Peter a good Jackson? Movie, though. But that's Ghosts. Fright Night is an 80s vampire movie where Chris Sarandon is the vampire. He's also very, like, seductive. But he's like a demon underneath, but we don't really see the demon until the end. But yeah, he's just, like, very sexy...
Wait, was that a Tales from the Crypt sort of, like... like a Jason film?
No direct correlation, but it's like it definitely feels similar, where it's like a horror comedy. Yeah, it's really good. You should watch it. But it's another like seductive vampire movie that's secretly an ugly vampire, but he's seductive passing, I guess. I don't know.
Seductive passing. I love it.
Nosferatu in the Night actually.
He's not like that at all, which I thought was interesting.
Yes, which also seductive as vampire.
He's a demon, vampire? But he's a seductive demon.
It's vampire coded, I will say.
It's like an undead demon. It's like, and he can convert people into being undead demons. Right. So it's pretty vampire core. Yeah, it's true.
Yeah, which is interesting because it seems like vampires and zombies are the two that can turn. And this is the first time besides Friday Night, now that you mention it, but this is the first time I'm really seeing vampires done the way that every vampire movie, I feel like, is a little bit different, especially with the turning, right? Sometimes it's very simple and quick. Sometimes it's like a whole elaborate rigmarole where you have to decide that you're going to turn somebody. But Sinners, to me, the pacing required people to be turned very quickly in that movie. Whereas Nosferatu isn't turning anybody.
He's turning them on.
He's taking a lot of their energy.
Yeah.
Ooh, hoo, hoo. Except Nicholas Holt seemed a little traumatized after his time.
I know we touched on this earlier. Actually, just want to make this call out. There's a lot of 3 degrees of separation between all the casts in both films, being as Nicholas Holt was in Skins and Remick and Sinners was also in Skins.
So that's Jack O'Connell, right?
Yeah.
That guy's in. I've seen him in stuff. I haven't seen Skins, but he's in. He's one of those guys. Angelina Jolie movie, Unbroken, I think, right?
Yes. Well, Jack O'Connell has been around the block. Actually, when I saw him in Skins, in that season, I just knew that he was. I mean, Nicholas Holt's Tony, that he was definitely a standout character, and it would definitely wouldn't be the last we saw of him. So it's really great that he's really his star is continuing to rise. I think he did a great job in Sinners. I think it's very hard to play opposite Michael B. Jordan and sort of steal those scenes. And I feel like he really brought something really fun to the character. And even in those unexpected dance numbers, I was like, that could have been really whack, but I was like,
I loved it.
It's giving. I'm here for it.
I like that they made him. I felt it was interesting choice to make him Irish specifically, because first of all, it gave him an old world European feel, but also just knowing socially where Americans put Irish people for a long time in terms of the discrimination that they experienced, which I thought was interesting. Then when he had the conversation with Smokestack, Wolf, One, I can't remember at this point, but when he talks about the fact that the people they bought the sawmill from were clan members and that they were going to come back and kill them regardless. He's dead either way. That was the point in time in the movie when I was almost convinced, where I would have probably been like, you know what? You make a good point. Turn me. Let's go eat all the Ku Klux Klan members, which I love. A villain that can make a good argument. I love a villain where you're like, maybe he has a point. I don't know. And I think making him Irish kind of added this extra layer to that in a sense, because I feel like he probably could have related to the discrimination, especially being a vampire. Who knows how long he had been in America as an Irishman when he was turned. You know, he may have related to them on a deeper level than would be immediately obvious. But he does also want to slaughter all of them and make them into vampires, so he's still a bad guy. But I liked that little extra characterization it gave him, and he was great.
I also like the hive mind thing, where when he turns somebody, he absorbs all their memories. I don't totally remember what the rules are for every vampire. I feel like it kind of varies, but I don't remember the hive mind thing being a thing. I know in the Borg and Star Trek, they are hive mind where you assimilate somebody, and then you get all their memories.
God, that scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. I was convinced I'd be taken over by the Borg.
They're pretty great, because they're zombie vampires.
That hive mind mentality was really interesting and reminded me sort of like the almost like the invasion of the body snatchers sort of idea. Where sort of we're all connected to each other and we are sharing the memories and information was interesting.
But it also was interesting because despite him subsuming their memories, it seemed like each vampire individually maintained their own personality too. And I think this stood out to me when Smoke killed his wife when she got bitten, and Mary, who was at that point a vampire, express how upset mm-hmm. she was that he had killed her and she wasn't going to become a vampire. And that to me indicated that they're not mindless, like, servants of this vampire necessarily. They still have, and honestly, that's what saved her in the end, because she ran off. She was so upset that he had killed his wife. I'm blanking on her name right now.
Annie.
But Annie, yes. She was upset. So clearly they still got to keep their memories and their emotions and feelings towards the people around them, even after they returned, which to me is like not the worst version of being a vampire, honestly, if you can still have your own personality and still care about the people in your life, then, you know, I take that over some of the other versions.
Yeah, I mean, that reminds me a little bit of also like the True Blood vampires, also played by another Skarsgård.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, they're really, it runs deep. Which that point I think was interesting here too, is that sort of that humanity being in some ways like retained even through this sort of like, I keep saying transformation, but
I keep mentioning,
for lack of a better word, transformation. If you look at Nosferatu or Locke, for example, this monster still has
this powerful
passion towards Lily Rosette's character, Mina, and how that is like sort of like the driving force. Where what sort of like is the motivation for each of these like vampire
stories?
Is like love and protection and desire for community, or is it like the desire to destroy? And I think that's like interesting to look at both and see like what is pushing each character. Whereas you look at like Seinfeld's reaction to Mary, where she's like seems to want everyone to transform with them for a sense of like community and being able to stay together. Whereas Jack O'Connell's Remnick, like the original vampire, seems more of like says is about community, but
he wants the music.
Yeah.
He wants the music that See, and that's what's interesting, because these two movies are wildly different vampire movies, but at their core, a demon, a bad, evil creature is summoned by an innocent person who somehow is able to pierce that veil. Whether it's Sammy in Sinners or Lily Rose Depp's character in Nosferatu, they're both, ultimately the catalyst is exactly the same in both movies. And they both creatures are seeking that person, ultimately they've been summoned by that one person. So in Nosferatu, he wants Lily Rose Depp. And he will consume everything in his path in order to get to her specifically. And it's kind of the same in Sinners. They want Sammy. They want him. They want this otherworldly talent that he possesses. And they will do anything. They both will do anything to get to the ultimate person. It's just the difference is in Sinners, they're just turning people left and right and making them vampires. Whereas in Nosferatu, he's just unleashing a plague on the city in order to get to her.
Yeah.
But in both cases, they're like, hey, I will keep killing people till you come to me.
That's interesting. That's a good point. Because, yeah, like in Nosferatu, he just wants to kill everybody so that she's sort of isolated and sort of has no recourse, essentially.
Right. And he uses that against her. He's like, I will keep unleashing this plague and killing everyone around you until you come to me. And we do. We lose all, everybody ends up dying except for Nicholas Holt.
And Willem Dafoe.
And Willem Dafoe.
And that guy from
The
Witch.
And the cat. The cat also survives, which was very important to me.
Something I wanted to touch on between the two films, we've identified that at the core that they're actually very similar in the idea that like this vampire monster is motivated to connect to this one innocent individual. Where I feel like Nosferatu does that more successfully and tells that story and understanding that connection sort of the idea that they're meant to be together, undeniable, inevitable, versus in Sinners, I feel like we sort of get introduced to the idea of like the filly or like the voice that's so powerful, but we sort of like lose what its meaning is, I think, towards the end of the film. And I feel like that is to do with, I know you touched on it, Dora, the pacing. You really felt that it served well to help us like really get invested in the characters, but I felt like the slower pace at the beginning really hurt the the third act where we had to sort of like speed run through everything. And we lost some of the gravitas of like a lot of the heavier emotional moments, I thought, that we had just rushing through.
Interesting.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted more vampires and a little less setup because I felt like I got it, you know, and I was like, all right, let's get to it now because we know where this is going. But I mean, it was cool. It was cool, like table setting or whatever and building out the characters and emotional stuff. I thought the stuff in the bar was
really cool. I'm a slut for characterization. So I'm like, gimme. I want to love these people. I want to know them. I want to be in their world. And I didn't mind it. I mean, I totally see what you're saying, though. I mean, aside from their inciting incident, I feel like they're just trying to say very different things. And I feel like Ryan Coogler wanted you to fall in love with these characters so that you are sad when we lost them and you felt attached to them. And that's something that I feel like not enough movies that play in the same sandbox do that. Everybody's cannon fodder. They don't give you any reason to care about people. I think the characterization is one of the biggest problems with a lot of movies and television today. So it wasn't a deal breaker for me. I didn't mind it because I loved every minute of this world being built. It was a lot of the movie, though. I felt like they probably could have pared it down and I still would have felt equally attached to the characters, but you know it's coming. And I mean, I will say the movie does a great job of playing with tension. Because you just keep waiting. You're like, oh God, it's coming. But when is it coming? When is it going to happen? And the way they edit a lot of those scenes where they're cutting back and forth between multiple conversations and you feel the tension rising and you don't know when the other shoe is going to drop. And I felt like that was very effective. So, you know, I think that maybe if some of it was by design, maybe you were supposed to feel like edgy. But I can see how, it would be a little long. It felt like they could probably have shaved 15 and gotten the same point across.
Yeah. Were there any other decisions that either Ryan Coogler or Robert Eggers made that you felt was like really successful in either film or really hurt the films?
I thought the blues stuff, all the music stuff was really cool. I really liked that because it was like a good part of the movie. It was like a musical, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was really rad. You know, there's like several performance pieces. There's the whole thing about the history of blues music and how Sammy is sort of informed by the past and somehow the future, you know, in his playing and stuff. And then they channel him in the... Or should we... Maybe we'd save the mid-credit scene until later. But there is like a huge cameo later that sort of ties him into like the history of blues music, which I thought was really rad. And it was a really cool choice and a fun wrinkle that we don't really see in these movies a lot. It was nice to, in addition to all the table setting stuff, it was cool to have this whole thing about the foundation of blues music in this particular era in the American South. I thought it was fun. So I thought that was really effective.
I thought even just having the setting be what it was great. No, I wish that there were more period monster movies out there. Zombies, vampires, werewolves. Let's put them in Roman times. Let's put them in the Mississippi and the Delta. Like I want that. I want more stuff like Prey, where you're just putting a monster in a completely new setting and seeing how people in that time period would have handled it, right? I thought that Sinners was so refreshing in that sense because it was a great setting and the setting was great and it was a great way to also have a really diverse cast with a lot of people that you don't really aren't necessarily following their stories. You know, I loved the couple that had the grocery store, for example, and just getting these little organic ways to be invited into these people's worlds and their world that you haven't seen before. I thought made me really enjoy the movie a lot. So I was like, oh yeah, this is awesome. I'm really getting a peek into 1930s Mississippi, regardless of how accurate it was or not. I don't know because I wasn't there, but it's not something I see a lot, especially in the context of a vampire movie. It was just really killer in that sense. I just felt very, it was a breath of fresh air in a world where we are getting a lot of remakes.
I mean, I wholeheartedly agree. I mean, I love a period piece. I think especially seeing like places we don't really get to visit that often in this sense. I feel like one, like getting to really, you know, in Nosferatu, this like sleepy fictional like German town and just feeling like
from the costuming to the production design, just felt like we were in like a Dutch painting. It was just so insanely beautiful and mesmerizing. Yeah. And I just was in awe consistently throughout just like sort of how tasteful, restrained, considered, like every detail felt within each frame. It just really felt truly beautiful. Whereas the same with Sinners, really feeling like that's a time period that we don't really spend a lot of time in, especially within like the Black community in the South, and it not being this classic like story about discrimination, how we were so oppressed, versus like in a lot of ways a story of like joy and success, and seeing how the communities, despite all the disadvantages, despite all the cards being stacked against them, still found ways to continue to like thrive and try and succeed and, you know, pursue that American dream. Totally. I did appreciate a lot of the musical numbers, and especially later in the films when we had a nod towards how music has like really transformed throughout history, especially when within communities of color. That was cool to see. I really had an inner struggle with how much I wanted this Sinners particularly to stay like faithful to like being 1932 historically accurate when it's a movie about vampires. So there's some moments with like where I felt Nosferatu, I never doubted for a second that this was like they would be wearing this. Like this is where they would be. This is the room they would stand in. This is what they would say.
That's Robert Eggers.
Robert Eggers.
This is my favorite part.
He is a historian. He doesn't miss. He digs in. He's true to the details. Ryan Coogler.
I mean, though, if we're talking about things that made the movie fall apart, North American bird call in Germany. Bad Robert Come Eggers. On,
sloppy. The wrong sloppy. Bird call.
North American loon in Germany. Ruined. Took me out of the movie completely.
Well, that's it. Ryan Coogler, like, for example, some things actually, you know, I felt like with the score, for example, there was a lot of moments where I felt like I got taken out of the movie in the time period where I felt like a little bit more of that restraint I wish had been practiced in those moments.
Oh, I loved that. How he would, there would be like an electric guitar lick randomly. I thought that was great. I mean, I see your point, Armani, but for me, it's a vampire movie, so I'm going to give it some liberties, especially when it's not somebody like Robert Eggers, who's literally obsessed with exactly replicating the aesthetic, which is his whole deal, in my opinion. It's why I like him. I'm a big fan of his, because he's like, if they had an ugly hairdo in the 1830s, I'm giving her the triangle part.
You do.
I'm giving her a 10 head. I'm doing it. I'm going there, because a lot of period films, they will modernize the hair and makeup, especially to appeal to a modern audience. And it bothers me because I'm like, they would have had thin eyebrows. Yes. Okay. Every woman had thin eyebrows in the '30s, and all these movies are just cowards. They will not give them the proper, I don't care if it looks bad, give her the thin eyebrows. I want to be in the illusion. Right. But with Sinners, to me, it wasn't, Eggers is always trying to do that. That's his, I think his first and foremost goal is to be as accurate and perfect to the era as possible. Whereas Sinners, I was just here for the ride. You know, I can forgive a lot more, because for me, I wasn't watching it for the measured, perfect period accuracy. I was watching it because I wanted to watch vampires, people fight vampires. So, you know, your mileage may vary, I guess, with that, but it did, I wouldn't say Sinners was as accurate, at least in terms of production design, but it wasn't enough to take me out of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Steeped is a good way to describe it. Yeah. Well, especially that the big scene with the different eras of music kind of mixing together, I think was a big part of what made me a little bit more forgiving, because, you know, they're already pulling from all these mm-hmm. places. So when you get a little electric guitar lick in your soundtrack, even though it's the 1930s, at that point, we've seen a guy play the electric guitar in that dance hall. So I'm like, all right, you're calling back to one of the most, in my opinion, probably the most important scene in the movie. But I also feel like Coogler is trying to say something very different and heavy about race and community. Whereas I think I think their goals were ultimately mm-hmm. different, although their movies do have some similarities. Eggers was trying to recreate his perfect vision for how he would have made Nosferatu and was very faithful to the original story. Whereas Coogler is working in a whole different sandbox. He's not in the same world as Eggers. He doesn't care because he's more focused on what he's trying to say about the community and the time and Armani, as you mentioned, like people coming together and despite having the cards stacked against them, finding this joy and community and connection and caring for each other.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Yeah. You know, Eggers, I would be like, dude, if he did something inaccurate, I would be a lot more disappointed with him because he's kind of made that his whole bag.
I mean, I think with that being said, that really makes me think of something like the idea here is that because Robert is Robert, like I know him, is like presenting, has a luxury, like as being like a white male, telling like what is essentially like a Eurocentric story, has a luxury of just like, right. Well, I don't have to say anything else, but just show this area, this vibe, just say true to it and execute it very well. Whereas like Ryan Coogler has to like check, is trying to, in his film, trying to cover a lot of territory here. Not only are you trying to be somewhat faithful to the era, but you're also trying to do a service to like the Black community at large, while also highlighting the historical context that all this like ties back into itself and paying homage to, like as we mentioned, the past, present, and future. So he's got a lot more territory that he has to cover. It doesn't have the luxury of just doing sort of like a paint by numbers depiction of the 1930s sharecropper setting. Like he's also trying to say the bigger right. message of like, as a whole, what this time period, what this film, what the idea of like exploitation and sharing of cultures and like culture vulturing and like the choice of like what it means to be free and Black and also participate in like capitalism. And then also what does it mean to like stay true to your artistry? And also that also means that you're being exposed to certain things that can corrupt you spiritually, morally. So with that being said, you know, a lot of the scores, a lot of some of the clothes weren't exactly accurate, but you know what? We had a lot to do today. So
yeah.
As you play out of doors, some forgiveness.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I had a blast watching Sinners. Nosferatu, I enjoyed a lot because I am a Robert Eggers girly. Lighthouse is probably one of my favorite movies of all time. So I'm willing to grade him on a curve, I guess. But what I liked more about Sinners was what it was trying to say. I don't think there's anything wrong with making a movie that just is a vision and a vibe and you want to just make something really cool and really perfect mm-hmm. and measured and very immersive in this specific world. But Sinners was just so refreshingly different. And I loved that it was ambitious. It's trying to say a lot. And I think it really got across a lot of interesting things. Maybe sometimes he didn't stick the landing necessarily, or we ask ourselves what he was trying to say by some of this, but there was a lot to dig into. I loved the element of showing the sharecroppers. You know, that's not something that I see in movies a lot. And to show, I think of, for example, when he goes to get the door guy and his wife is in the field with him and she kind of has a little say in this conversation where they ask him if he wants to go and he's like, no. And they say something rude about his wife and she's like, but how much money? you know, gay, just humanizing everywhere, giving us these little moments with these characters that made the world feel so lived in, and giving you a window into this world specifically, I thought was just, there could have been no vampires and I probably still would have been into it, but the knowing that they were coming, I think gave it this air of tension that you already know you're losing these characters and you're sad about it because you're getting these really endearing moments.
Yeah, and I think to that point also, with that being able to, dang it, I lost it. Ah, we're there. I'll keep going and come back to me. I adore you. It's inspired me to say something.
We were talking about, let me see, jog your memory. So we were talking about the being immersed in these worlds and humanizing these people and how they are.
Oh, I mean, also, like, I think also that's a great point going into also, like, showing, giving them a sort of a dignity and sort of a pride. I think a lot of times you look down on people who were sharecroppers during that time and really just be able to say this is the first time there wasn't really a ladder to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, quote unquote, but the idea that there was some sort of like entrepreneurial spirit even then that was alive and sense of like pride in your work was also something great to see.
All the people in that movie were entrepreneurs. We had a sign painter that also owned a grocery store. We had the hoodoo wife who was selling potions and stuff. Everyone in that movie, you saw a way that they were hustling. They were finding ways to support themselves and each other. Even our twins stealing money from Al Capone. You know, they were the most ambitious of all. And you don't see that with any of the clan members, honestly. They're all just...
Creeps,
yeah.
Oh, they are musicians. Although, are they musicians or did they become musicians after the vampire turned them?
The vampire
came after.
Remick made them musicians.
It's giving like K-pop forced boot camp play.
Fair enough. Yeah, fair enough.
Oh, man. Remick, sequel, Remick somehow is resurrected and goes to Korea and starts.
That's where you should have
putting together bands. That I would watch, honestly, I would watch a million. I was saying to my partner after we saw it, I would love to just see the 60 years between the end of the movie and the post-credit scene. I just want to see Stack and Mary just.
I do want to see that, yes.
When they roll in the 90s, I'm like, oh yeah, this is hilarious. I want to know what they've been doing for the last 60 years.
Yeah, I thought it was really fun because I remember the flash forward, and then they have Buddy Guy just like jamming on guitar in Chicago, and I had a hero. I was like, well, "What is Buddy Guy doing with this?" And then they're like, "Oh, and Buddy Guy."
I was like, "Where are they?"
The credits. But yeah, then we see Jack and Mary as vampires, very 1992 core, enter the blues bar after hours and say, "What's up to Buddy Guy?" Which is Sammy, old Sammy, 1992. They offer to turn him, and he demurs, and they tell him that they promised, well, Stack tells him that he promised a dying Smoke that he would not, actually, no, Smoke was not dying at the time. Smoke was going to kill him, my bad. But he promised them that, Stack promised Smoke that if he would leave Sammy alone to live out his life. And he offered to turn him, and Sammy demurred, and then just kind of like hugged and went their separate ways.
Which... again, was so fascinating, which shows that the vampires in this universe have some sort of autonomy where, you know, unlike maybe True Blood or Twilight, where if there's blood or they're like so hungry, right? It's so hard for them to resist and to not suck your blood. But these vampires kept their distance. They kept their promise. They stayed away from Sammy. They didn't visit him until he was at the end of his life. And when he demurred, they were like, all right. And they moved on. And I found that very interesting because it seems that these types of vampires in Sinner specifically have more autonomy than a lot of other vampires that I see in movies. And it made me very interested. I would watch sequels. I would watch more movies about these vampires and see. I would watch a prequel about Remick. Where did he come from? How was he turned? There's a lot that you, even more that you could kind of expand on in this world, because these vampires seem to keep their personalities and have some sort of moral code where they don't just eat whoever.
That was cool.
Necessarily.
I will say, like, the coolest thing about this movie, I think, was that it's Cougar's first totally original movie, because Fruitvale Station is based on a real incident, and then everything else is an adaptation or something. And it was so crazy to see all the different avenues he wanted to explore with full control through his team, Warner Brothers. So I'm down for more stuff in this world for sure, but I don't think there's any rush, and I want to see him do something else that's totally original. Like, I don't know what he would do next, but I want to see
it. Yeah. He's got a blank check now. Exactly. He's got a blank check. So I hope that they keep giving him opportunities to make original stuff. And I hope he keeps feeling like he wants to prove something to us, because I feel like that's when directors are at their best. So hopefully he can continue to really do some strong work. Yeah. And I'm really interested to see what else he can do, because I was really impressed by this movie, especially, I mean, it's been doing gangbusters. It's been doing better than any original movie since Nope, I think, was the last movie that made this much. That was an original IP. And that's, do we want to talk about that before we leave? Is the Variety's reaction to this and the way the studios are freaking out?
Yeah, let's touch on it.
Did you look in any of
that? I did not. Educate us, Adora, drop it.
Oh, I will drop some knowledge on you. So Coogler made a deal with Warner Brothers that he gets the rights back to this movie in 25 years. He gets to own the film. That is a big deal. And it basically is a director banking on themselves. And the fact that this movie is very successful has a lot of studios very worried that more directors, when they become successful, are going to leverage similar deals. It's funny because Tarantino allegedly did the same thing for Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and everyone touted this as a genius move and so brilliant. And then Coogler does the same thing. And all the headlines were like, oh, Sinners might have done pretty okay kind of this weekend, but they spent $90 million making it. So they've got a long way to go till profitability. At that point, I would have spite watched it if I wasn't already interested, because it was so irksome to me that these studios were, because these entertainment platforms they're all kind of owned by the same people, and they're the people that don't want directors to have power. The studios want to have power over the directors, and a move like this from Coogler is something that makes the studio sweat, because they do not want to give him more power.
I mean, I would argue that it's probably, I mean, taking a page out of Tarantino's book, well, taking a move from Tarantino's playbook, sports reference there. I think also Coogler probably learned from his time at Marvel. I mean, look at how successful Black Panther is and how entrenched that is now in the zeitgeist in popular culture. And I think it's only fair that when you helm a ship that big, that you should be able to retain, you know, I mean, obviously there's royalties involved and things like that, but ultimately, you know, having that creative control, we understand why that'd be so important to him. Especially if there's franchisability on the horizon.
Yeah, it's super cool. I think that it's really strange, the media framing. It feels like someone wrote this on film Twitter, and I thought this was a good point. It feels like because like this, there's like a bidding war to get him to do this movie, and Warner Bros. Won. But other someone on Twitter was like, "Yeah, it seems as if the other studios that missed out are jealous, and so they're just sort of feeding Variety these angles or whatever." I thought that was pretty funny. But I think it's a cool thing that he's doing, and I hope that I think like the Marvelization movie has been super annoying, and so it's cool that he can get out of it and do his own thing, and he's being rewarded by this huge reception from audiences and critics, and I hope more people follow that lead. I know I'm starving for original studio movies again, you know, movies with a budget that are not based on anything else, and so I thought it was really cool from that perspective. Like, even more, like, I thought the movie was really good. There's elements of it that we talked about that, like, don't totally work for me, but I thought it was overall really good. I can't wait to watch it again, and I'm just super excited for, hopefully, studio, I mean, I don't know, but hopefully studios can learn from this and do this again with other creators, you know? That would be nice. And especially, like, different voices and not just, like, I don't know, the same old, And it also is, you know, this is someone of our generation too. This guy's like our age, you know, and it's a lot of these older directors trying to do these like nostalgia trip movies. And like, I just don't want that anymore, you know?
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, there's only so many times you can remake a movie before it really. Yeah. I have such Marvel fatigue. Like, there's another Fantastic Four. How many times have we rebooted this movie now? This is like the third three? One, yes. Is this the third?
The third reboot.
I mean, Pedro Pascal has me a bit seated, but I don't think Pedro Pascal is going to get me in the theater.
No, not at all. I mean, to Edgar's credit, I mean, taking on a remake is difficult and making people excited about it. And he did stick the landing. And I think that it's his attention to detail and he's obviously his ability to just really be able to highlight nuance within actors' performances, within the settings themselves, is really just a testament to, like, you know, his craft and his ability. And I think that's...
I was just going to say, I think that's the big thing holding me back from loving the Nosferatu thing, is I've seen so many Dracula movies, and I love so many Dracula movies, that I just knew where I was going the whole time. And if I was, like, a 15-year-old kid and I wasn't exposed to all the stuff I've been exposed to Dracula movie-wise, I think I would have been way more into it. So I think that's part of it, is like the fatigue that like our generation older folks have probably with this story. Because it felt almost like, you know, watching like the Baz Luhrmann Romeo and Juliet or whatever, or like the Kenneth Branagh movie. Mm-hmm. It's just like, it's a cool rendition of a very familiar story. And so it's very well done, but it like has a ceiling that like something like Sinners doesn't, because Sinners is such a special, unique, original thing. But Nosferatu was like really good for what it was, for sure. And like, yeah, and like so much of it is like respecting the craft behind it, because like, you know what the story is, so you're sort of enjoying the intricacy of the technical aspects and the casting.
Right. You appreciate it more for the how it's made and the precision.
Yes.
Than necessarily, you're not watching it for the story. You're watching it because you're watching a familiar story played out by someone at the top of their game. I mean, I will say, again, like I already brought up The Lighthouse, but that in comparison is an audaciously original film. So for me, it was going to be really hard to follow up The Lighthouse with something as ambitious, because that movie is just batshit bonkers in my favorite way. And you're just not going to get anything more original.
What I will say is that watching, if I were to compare the two films, Robert Eggers' Nosferatu reminds me of when you go to an orchestral performance, you're watching them perfectly execute like a Bach, a Beethoven, like really, you're just seeing that precision and that sort of mastery of their instruments and understanding of the piece itself. When you go to see Sinners, you're there to see almost a gospel performance where there's more riffing. You're there for the soul, the spirituality, the sort of like being part of that celebratory moment. And it's less about precision, it's more about the feeling and the passion itself. So at its core, I think that's maybe the two differences between these two films here, is that maybe they were singing the same song, but their approaches were very different to how they wanted to overall execute that piece.
That's a great way of putting it. You nailed it. That's exactly it. I think Sinners is, you're just here for a good time. You're here to have a good time. You're here to learn, get learned up on a few things, but there's no Nosferatu. It's a technical exercise in reaction. But thank you guys so much for jumping on this pod. It's been a minute. It feels really good to talk, be back, connect with you guys. I know that we're all over the place.
I love nerding out about movies anytime you want to compare.
Well, thank you guys for listening. We'll catch you back on the next one. We'll hopefully bring you back a few more this year, as we dabble back into the podosphere.
Thanks, Armani.
Thanks, Armani.
Thank you.
Something I've been wanting to tell you for a long time. It might hurt you. Hope you don't lose your mind. Well, I was just a boy, about 8 years old. You threw me a Bible on that Mississippi road. See, I love you, Papa. You did all you could do. They say the truth hurts, so I lied to you. Yes, I lied to you. I love the blues. Take me in your arms tonight. Well, alright. Somebody take me.